Recording in progress.
And rarely.
only thing you have to do to prove you're a member of Soul Sisters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can, if you really want to be persnickety about it, you can say, move to approve it and just note, you know, majority of mental health board,
yeah,
medical and present for.
Okay.
And then move forward. Just note it for the minutes, and if somebody wants to take it all the way to the.
You should get one of your own.
You've got several.
I'm blown away, honestly, at the tech. I've been trying to figure out, like,
oh, it's such a difference,
like,
from Brookins.
Oh,
my
gosh.
Yeah. No, it, like, blew my mind when I went.
It's pretty nice, isn't it? Hey, to cool the folks in the Zoom in on what we're doing, we haven't started yet because we're trying to figure out some procedural issues, but I think we're ready. So if you're ready to go, we've got lots of people, and folks can come and sit up here around the oval. There's lots of room. We like your picture, Susan. We like the... I like thinking about cappuccino.
We will now call to order this evening's study session of the Champaign County Developmental Disabilities Board and the Champaign County Mental Health Board, Wednesday, October 29th, 2025 at 5:45 p.m. in the Shields Carter Room of the Bennett Administrative Center, Urbana, Illinois. May I have a roll call?
Alejandro Gomez. Chris Miner.
On Zoom.
Tony Nichols. Elaine Palencia.
Here.
Kyle Patterson. Emily Rodriguez.
Here.
Jane Sprandel.
Here.
John Paul Joachim.
Here.
Molly McClay.
Here.
Susan Fowler.
Here.
Neil Sharma. Kim Fisher.
Here.
Ann Robin.
Here.
Vicki Nicewander.
Here.
All right. Thank you very much. So
this is Alejandro. Sorry. Alejandro Gomez here. Sorry.
Thank you.
A little quick.
Thank you.
So, Stephanie, a lot of those folks are not in the room, not physically in the room, right? So in the room we have Emily Rodriguez, Ann Robin, Jane Sprandel, John Paul Joachim, Elaine Palencia, and Molly McClay.
Yes, so we have a quorum of mental health board members in the room. We do not have a quorum of developmental disabilities board members in the room. So we cannot formally admit the members who are on virtually. I guess the mental health board could, since we have a quorum, virtually admit our members, but it doesn't really matter because this is a study session, so the only thing we're voting on is the agenda. So MHB members, do you feel strongly about trying to admit the virtual members? It doesn't matter. We can maybe just note for the record who is present virtually. Okay, so next we will move to approve the agenda, and again, only the mental health board members in the room can vote on this. So we have an agenda here for the study session. Would anyone like to make any comments, changes, or move to approve it? Rodriguez moves to approve. Can I get a second?
I'll second.
Joachim seconds. All those in favor of approving the agenda as presented, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The ayes have it. The agenda is approved. Next, we will move to public participation and agency input. As always, members of the public are welcome to come to the Mental Health Board and Developmental Disabilities Board to make public comments. We cannot respond to comment directly, but we will use it to inform future decisions. For anyone who is making comment to us, please be aware of the Illinois Lobbyist Registration Act and take appropriate steps to be in compliance with the act. For those who do want to make comment, I do want to mention that this is a study session where there'll be open discussion about the topic at hand, which is resources and needs of immigrants and refugees. So We will have time for public comment then, but this is our formal public comment time now as well. So if you would like to make comment, you can either approach the podium, you can fill out a comment card, or if you're on Zoom, you can raise your hand or put something into the chat. I may limit individual time to 5 minutes and total time to 20 minutes for speaking. Given that, is there anybody who would like to make public comment now? There is no one in the room approaching and no one online who has indicated. There will be another time to make formal public comment at the end as well. So given that there's no one to make comment, we will move forward. So we will first hear from the presidents of the two boards. So first, Vicki Nysmonder, would you like to make any comments?
I don't have any particular comment to make other than I look forward to this session and learning a lot about immigrants and refugees in our community. I know that there are many concerns, and so thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much. Next, we will move to Mental Health Board comments from President Molly McClay. That is me. I also just want to thank everybody for being here and say that I am really looking forward to this study session as well. I think it is more important than ever before, given what is going on in our country, to make sure that this community is a welcoming space for immigrants and refugees, and to make sure that we are centering the mental health of this community, because right now it's under attack. And I am very grateful that our boards have decided to have this study session. And I really hope to learn a lot and hope that we can provide a supportive space for people to share. Before we move to the next part, I guess this is sort of introducing the next part. The way the study session is going to work is that I will be deferring the chairmanship to another board member. And he and our associate director, Leon Bryson, will both have comments, and then they will sort of work together. I think Leon probably introduced the presenters as they come up to speak, and then we'll have some other resources available. So with that, I want to, the next item on the agenda is to have comments from our board member facilitating the session. And we have asked Dr. John Paul Joachim to please to facilitate this session, given his passion for this area and advocacy for this on the board, as well as the fact that he is our past vice president and past president. So with that, I turn it over to you.
Thanks, Molly. so, you know, first I'll start off saying, it's an honor to lead this study session as the son of immigrants. My dad came here at 18 years old from Palestine after the 67 war. He hid in the Church of Nativity with my with his brothers and sisters and his father for about 10 days, and then they came here after that, coming here with not knowing anybody, just, you know, the shirt on their backs. Growing up here in Champaign-Urbana has been something I have just greatly enjoyed. I felt like as a kid here, everybody knows everybody. Didn't matter what social class, what background you came from, everybody was friends with everybody. What you picture America should be. And sadly, the older I've gotten, the more that seems more like a dream, and that wasn't real or just went away. And it hurts seeing that happen. You know, we are here today to talk about some of our most vulnerable community members. You know, we talk about immigration and immigrants. We talk usually about laws and borders, but we rarely talk about mental health. You know, under the administration, immigration enforcement has intensified in ways that has left deep psychological scars on many immigrants and refugees in our community and across the nation. And, you know, one example is over 5,000 kids were separated from their parents at the border since the policy in 2018 of the zero tolerance policy. Pediatricians reported severe trauma in those children, nightmares, anxiety, PTSD. The American Academy of Pediatrics called the policy government-sanctioned child abuse. Inside ICE detention centers, the Physicians for Human Rights described widespread depression, panic attacks, even suicide attempts among detained asylum seekers. Some have even died from lack of medical attention. In communities across the U.S., we see constant ICE raids creating fear. In 2019, ICE raided Mississippi, which led to the arrest of over 600 workers, leaving hundreds of children suddenly without parents. Schools reported spikes in absenteeism and anxiety the next day. In Georgia recently, we had over 300 Korean immigrants that were treated like criminals and arrested and deported to South Korea. but it's not just that, it's also what people in power say. Like when Trump called immigrants rapists, animals, invaders, when he calls immigrants poisoning the blood of our country, hearkening us back to a time of fascism and internment camps. Many immigrants feel it's just a matter of time before they are placed in an internment camp with no recourse for justice or freedom. Trump referred to Haitians and African countries as shithole countries. He used Palestinians as a racial slur against Democratic opponents. He claimed that Haitians in Iowa and Ohio were eating dogs. Palestinians and those who support Palestinians are arrested for speaking out against the genocide. All the attacks against immigrants have taken a toll on the fabric of our society, of our ideals, of what it means to be a community. Psychologists have found that even immigrants with legal status reported higher stress levels and symptoms of depression during this time. Yet despite the trauma, immigrant communities have shown remarkable resilience. Organizations have stepped up into providing therapy, legal aid, and emotional support to families recovering from separation and fear. Sadly, when a nation's leaders dehumanize a group of people, it sends a message that they're not welcome, not valued, not safe. It reminds the children of those parents who they hear when their parents are called illegal in the minds of refugees who thought they finally had escaped persecution that they're not truly welcomed. And if we truly care about justice and we remember that immigration is not a political issue, it's a human one, that immigrants are people, hopefully we can then begin to heal and replace that fear with compassion and recognize that mental health is a right and not a privilege, and that we're all here not by legal status. We're here by, what makes us American, that we want a better life for ourselves, for our children, for our families, and that, immigration is part of the fabric of America. And if we just turn our backs on that, then we don't really believe in what all of this is supposed to be about. And so today we're here to talk about how those organizations in our community are helping those families, those children, survive and hopefully thrive and become resilient through all this trauma. It's hard to be optimistic, but the agencies here do give me hope, and I am glad that we're having this study session so we can hear the work that they are doing, why we are supporting them, why we need to continue supporting them. And with that, I'll pass on to Leon Bryson.
All right, good evening. So I have a statement and a question, and perhaps it may be answered a little bit later this evening. So I think Dr. Joaquin took some of my thunder, but here goes. The courage and sacrifice to leave all behind for a better life, the American dream, has it been worth it? As mentioned, tonight's study session will focus on Champaign County's immigrant and refugee resources and needs. Our presenters include Maria Jimenez, Executive Director of Immigrant Services of Champaign, Urbana; Awad Awad, Director of the UIUC Salaam Cultural Center; and Lisa Wilson, Executive Director of the Refugee Center. Their profiles and organizational details are included in tonight's board packet. We have requested that our distinguished presenters limit their presentations to 10 to 15 minutes to allow for a stimulating discussion. Without further ado, we will hear from Maria Jimenez, then Awad Awad, followed by Lisa Wilson. Maria, the microphone is yours.
Thank you. Honestly, hard not to get choked up there both times. So thank you for setting the space so beautifully, because it really is important to constantly remind ourselves of why it is important to have these conversations. This is not a job that I ever really imagined for myself, and I'm still learning every day. I'm often in rooms where I'm referred to as an immigration expert, and I by no means am an immigration expert, but I do know what it's like to be an immigrant. I know what it's like to watch your parents consecutively watch the news waiting for a moment of hope. And I know what it's like to be in very close proximity to the communities that are starting to feel scared to leave their homes, that are starting to feel scared to send their kids to school. A good example is last week we did an event at Urbana Middle School. It was a really wonderful event, presentation from the Mariachi Tigers, which is, you know, the kids there have the opportunity not just to join band, but if they want to be in mariachi, they can, which I think is just a beautiful and cultural immersive experience that really is a testament to a lot of the work that immigrants in local schools are doing to try to make immigrants feel safer. It was a really exciting event, except we show up and the projected amount of people that was going to be there dropped significantly because ICE was there the day before at Lincoln Square Mall. And so their presence alone is, this mic sounds kind of weird, so I don't know if I'm, but their presence alone when they come into our community, the ripple effect that it has on keeping people iced into their own homes and afraid to go out and seek resources, I think is one of the biggest things that I'm seeing personally in our work, and I know our caseworkers are carrying really heavily. I think there's also this pressure to acknowledge that a lot of the main work that's being done in our community to help immigrants is being done by immigrants. So when we talk about mental health specifically with immigrants, I think we, you know, particularly the program that I'm really trying to implement with ISCU for the mental health program, I'm particularly seeking out therapists who are immigrants themselves, even if it's second generation, but who have a relationship to what it's like to walk in those shoes. And I think that that's important. I think that immigration across the spectrum, whether you come because you're fleeing persecution or whether, you know, my story was a little bit more my parents coming literally just to seek the American dream. Irregardless, it is one of the most traumatic things that you can experience to be uprooted from your life, from everything you've ever called home, and then to come to a country that dehumanizes you in almost every way possible. I don't know if you guys saw the USDA website today, so I'm going to read it out loud. If you go to USDA.gov, there's a big red writing at the top that says, Senate Democrats have now voted 12 times to not fund the food stamp program, also known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Bottom line, the well has run dry. At this time, there will be no benefits issued November 1st. We are approaching an inflection point for Senate Democrats. They can continue to hold out for health care for illegal aliens and gender mutilation procedures, or reopen the government so mothers, babies, and the most vulnerable among us can receive critical nutrition assistance. That word illegal alien is like a word that's like, those two words have like haunted me my entire life. It's terrible to hear. It's also horrible to see on a government website. And so needless to say, food insecurity has been probably one of the most, I think, difficult things to see all across the board when serving immigrants. And we're not just talking about like not having enough money to go to the grocery store and get enough like food for the week, but we're talking about like we don't know how they're going to be able to eat that night. This year, we were lucky enough to be able to say, okay, like, we've got to do something about this. And we kind of implemented like a mock SNAP program before this even happened. So we do distribute gift cards that we give out on like a 6-week basis every 2 weeks. And that's calculated with family members and children. And all those things are taken into accord. And then we're constantly doing drives in the community with churches and with just student-led organizations that give us donations of canned items and grains and things like this that we know have a high shelf life. And so a lot of the times we can't meet the exact demands that our clients would really need to be stabilized, but we're making sure they're leaving with something. And if that means food, that means food. We started a diaper distribution program, and honestly, that has just, it's been incredible to see how receptive the community has been to that. And so making sure that, like I said, they're leaving with something, they're leaving with supplies has been huge. But the pressure is really picked up, and I feel specifically for, like I said, employees and what they're carrying every single day, interfacing with these communities. There's violence in the community that has picked up. It's been there before, but it feels like it's picked up. The rates of domestic violence, won't go too much into it, but there's a lot of human trafficking that's also going on, and that's something we're discovering not for the first time, but really diving into how interconnected it is to all of these clients that we're serving. So that has been taking up a lot of our time. I do feel that the mental health program and being able to connect people to therapists who understand firsthand what they're facing in their native tongue, not with the translator, not with that delay of I can't actually build this relationship with you fully because I can't actually, you can't hear the pain in my voice and the way that I'm saying it is, I'm just really proud of it. That being said, it's like I'm really starting to see how much it needs to grow. I learned recently that Champaign County, for example, doesn't have a Spanish AA meeting, right? So if you think of it, some of these like essential things when we think about people having access to recovery or even just support groups that kind of cover these like main bases of issues that we think about, a lot of them don't exist yet. So I really want to branch out beyond just the individual therapy and look at these, okay, like support groups for domestic violence specifically, and kind of like look at these specific issues that we know these communities face a lot. And to think about the power in co-regulation and in individuals that share a specific pain or a specific trauma, not necessarily having to go to talk therapy and potentially re-traumatizing themselves in a situation where, I mean, when it's a systemic issue, that therapist and them are not going to be able to just necessarily resolve that. So I'm just really starting to think a lot more moving forward about doing that in, like I said, in co-regulation in spaces. We had one earlier this month, and we actually did some of the survey questions that you guys sent out. We folded those into the process that we did, and it was really beautiful to see the result of, you know, breaking out into groups and just being able to ask these questions of, like, you know, what did you think it was going to be like when you came, and then what was it actually like? And there's so much wisdom and pain in those stories that's important, I think, for us to listen to. But yeah, I guess all in all, what I see as being my main focus in all of this is just the amount of stories that I have listened to firsthand that when you hear them, it's not, I wanted to go to the United States so I could make money and send it back home. That's what my family experienced. We're talking about fleeing government persecution. We're talking about religious persecution. We're talking about gang violence that gets to the point where mothers are thinking, if I don't go to the United States, it's only a matter of time until my children are kidnapped. We're talking about people who have a family member murdered in their own living room, and the next day it's a backpack with a couple t-shirts. We're talking about walking to the southern border from South America. And so I think that regardless of the argument or where people stand, we have to at least like tell the truth of these stories and why people are actually deciding to come to the United States. And until we do that, I don't even think we can fully process the best way to support them. So that's where I think, like, for me, I just want to share those stories, and I want to advocate for them in whatever space that I can. And thankfully, you guys are here today and willing to hear me share what I have to share, and I'm eternally grateful to you guys. So thank you.
I had thought about this earlier today, and I think I'm just going to commit to sitting in the control room. I can hear you, but that way I can control the cameras a little bit, because, like, this is a really important discussion, and I don't want to be distracted by the view anymore. So I'll be right in there.
Okay. Up next, we will hear from Awat, the director of the Salaam Cultural Center.
Good evening, all, and thank you for your time and for the invitation. It's indeed an honor. I am the director of the Salaam Middle East and North Africa Cultural Center at UIUC. We are one of the first cultural centers of our kind across the country. I believe we are either the fourth or the fifth. There's been five or six others that have opened after us across the country, and I'm in contact with every single one of the directors. There is no blueprint for what we're doing, but what Salaam is doing is providing a model for the rest of the country. And some of the things that we are doing to do that, for example, is, you know, how do you walk into a space like this where a person running for office can say something derogatory about your background and their points go up when they're running? I, too, am of Palestinian background. My parents emigrated to Latin America first before coming to the U.S. So, you know, growing up as a kid, I didn't know that everybody wanted to come over for Thanksgiving because we had amazing food. I just thought it was normal that we would have grape leaves and kibbeh and mashed potatoes and turkey and corn and sancocho and tamales and all on our spread. But this is what makes America, America, right? We are a sum of all of our parts. You walk into Salaam, and I hope your next meeting may be at Salaam. You're more than welcome to come and use the space. But you walk in there, and everything is really intentional. There's no maps because the indigenous people never drew the maps. It was always the colonial powers. So why should we let colonial narratives tell us who we are? And then at some point, those borders become solidified, and you colonize yourself with a flag by defining yourself against an other, and that other is usually your immediate neighbor. For example, when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you know, in different spaces that I've been in, I've been asked, you know, well, what's the problem? Why can't they come over? Why can't they this? What's this? What's that? And in essence, I would respond with, if you take anyone from either side and put them in Harvest Market and come back in an hour, their shopping carts would look almost identical. But you can't tell them that because of the power imbalances and the way that the narrative is portrayed to us in the West. Salaam, in all of its pronunciations, among the majority of Middle East and North African languages, whether it's pronounced as Salam, Salam, Shlama, Shlomo, Shalom, all means peace. But the hardest thing about peace is that it's made between enemies, not among friends. And most of the time, these enemies or perceived enemies are people who've never met and broken bread. And so how do we change that? What can Salaam do to help in this kind of context, especially when it deals with mental health and our different demographic communities? I mean, for one, I don't even know who our domestic demographic community is because there's no box for us to check. Currently, we're still being lost under white or under black. While the state of Illinois last year was the first state in the union to adopt MENA and Middle East and North Africa as a category for our next demographic for the census, the federal government followed suit. The current definition at the Office of Management and Budget is still limited. And so we could address that together as the city of Champaign and move it up the ranks. So that'd be the first and foremost, is to define who we are in our own terms, or allow us to define who we are in our own terms. When it comes to mental health, there is still stigma in the community surrounding mental health. So how do we also advocate and teach about mental health within those spaces? One thing that we can do, for example, is to learn from organizations like Arab American Family Services on the outskirts of Chicago and Bridgeview and their successes in working with the community. But one of the major gaps that I myself had been seeing my entire life, born and raised in the U.S., is this gap in intercultural understanding from the counselors and those that want to help. And this is where Salaam can be a great asset and a benefit of learning how to communicate with people on their own terms through worldviews that they understand and lenses that they've experienced growing up, I think would be first and foremost. Providing spaces like Salaam where the community can just come together to do nothing other than to drink tea and play card games, where they can feel safe in that space. One of the things that I'm doing for high schoolers, for example, is giving them remote internships where part of their internship is to document their family's story about how they came here and to interview their parents or their grandparents so that we could also preserve the languages and dialects of that particular generation and their stories. Food insecurity. You know, we can work together with the different food pantries around town. So, for example, if you have lentils available and you have rice, all that you would need is a recipe card that says, pick up an onion, have some cumin, salt and pepper, and you can make a dish that's popular in Levant called Mjaddara, which is the Palestinian dirty rice. So we can teach the community about our heritage through our own food, so people aren't afraid of us before they even meet us. I'm an academic, former academic, so I can talk forever if you give me the floor. But with that said, I just want to close it here to allow space for others to speak and for question and answer. But no, there's a lot that we can do. There's a lot that we can do, especially when it comes to Israel-Palestine, because it's the hottest topic here at the moment. Tensions on campus are rising because of it. It's only a matter of time before the ceasefire will falter in various different steps, resulting in possible flare-ups on campus, because some of the conditions that are in Trump's plan cannot be met and cannot be met immediately or fully. And we've also know that there's a particular person that has a long history of foiling agreements. So it's also a matter of time before that happens as well, if there isn't really strong backing from the U.S. government to ensure that the ceasefire takes place. But one of the things that we can do, for example, is for both communities that were affected by October 7th and those after it, their education sector. Why can't we give them access to our clouds and servers so they can have space in order to have courses online? Why can't we provide courses at the University of Illinois system to a new generation of administrators so they can be trained before the brick and mortar goes up? We have access to one of the best engineering programs in the entire world, not even country, especially in the field of transportation. We can create programs where graduate students can conduct research on how to best to help with the rebuilding process. Again, this is on all sides. This is something that we can actively do that would then also reflect the better mental health of our community by saying it's not hopeless. We can actually do something, and this is what we can do in our capacity. We should engage with these divisive narratives to create an alternative narrative, a third narrative that allows for reconciliation, that allows for moving forward. These are things that we can do. Do we have the guts to do it? That's a different story. But do many of us have the experience and are willing to roll up our sleeves? I sure am myself, and I'll be happy to help in any way that I can. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Director Awad. Up next, we have Executive Director Lisa Wilson from the Refugee Center. Lisa, take it away.
Thank you so much. Can everybody hear me? Yes, great. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to come and speak to the study session tonight. The Refugee Center has a long history in Champaign-Urbana and a long history of support from the Champaign County Mental Health Board, which we are extremely grateful for that support. It allows us to serve more people than we otherwise could. So thank you for that. What I wanted to talk about, what our immigrant neighbors are going to be facing in light of HR 1, which has also been called the Great Big Beautiful Bill. I have another name for it, but I digress. First of all, let me address what's going to happen on Saturday. On Saturday, there are going to be people that, even though we may have all followed the news and know that there aren't going to be any SNAP benefits paid out, we know there are people in our communities here that do not know this information. We've been trying to spread the word now for several days. We're trying to contact as many clients as we can. But I'm pretty sure Monday morning, we're going to find people walking into the Refugee Center telling us that they couldn't buy groceries over the weekend because their SNAP card didn't work. So this is going to be devastating on so many levels for our clients. Many of our clients do not have valid work authorization. It is hard for them to work at all. Some of them work under the table or work with somebody else's identification. And while we don't condone that, it's just a fact of life. And when now that employment authorization is being scrutinized more and more, it's been harder for our clients to find work. So we're facing a situation where it's harder to find work, and now their benefits are going to go away. When I speak to groups, I always tell them immigration is really complicated. Immigration qualification for public benefits is even more complicated. So in the U.S., undocumented people do not get benefits. However, we do have many mixed status families. For example, the parents may be undocumented and the children were born in the U.S. When they apply for SNAP benefits, there is a little math that takes place. That's the poverty level, their income, they produce pay stubs, and the household size. So with HR 1, what's going to happen if we ever get out of this shutdown is that for our mixed status families, they're going to reduce the amount of SNAP benefits. So for a family of four, if there's two citizens, they're getting the benefits for a family of two. So even after we get through this shutdown, our immigrant friends are facing a very dire situation. The first will be SNAP, and then after that will be Medicaid. At the Refugee Center, we serve refugees, asylees, and the overall umbrella term immigrants. Our refugee clients are legally in the country. They apply from outside the country through the United Nations Commissioner for Refugees. They were admitted into the country. A refugee resettlement agency, one of the big national agencies, promises to resettle them, and then they divide their quota among affiliates. And we are, were an affiliate. So even refugees and even people who have been granted asylum are going to lose benefits under this system. Right now, it is not clear what refugees will receive when they enter the country. Before the Trump administration, when a refugee entered the country, they entered with automatic employment authorization. That means they could find a job, even if they didn't have the card in their hand. They had status merely because they are categorized as refugees. And then they are immediately qualified for benefits. They don't have a job. We know their income is nothing. So they would get, in Illinois, they would get SNAP and Medicaid, or All Kids for the Kids, and either temporary assistance for needy families or for single people, refugee cash assistance. Right now, the federal government has not decided whether those refugees are going to get anything. They're hanging their hats on the legal permanent residence 5-year bar. So when you come in for, if you came in under family immigration, you would not, and you're a legal permanent resident, you would not be eligible for benefits unless, until you had been a legal permanent resident for 5 years. And now they're trying to enforce that on all of the statuses. So we have people who have had no means to earn anything, and now we're taking away any kind of food benefit and Medicaid benefit that they might get. It's really quite shocking to see that all of the statuses where our immigrant friends would have access to SNAP and Medicaid now will not. And that includes, like I said, refugees, asylees, domestic violence victims, the Violence Against Women Act applicants, trafficking victims who apply for a T visa, victims of other crimes who apply for a U visa, anybody who's here on humanitarian parole, and even for temporary protected status. They're going to cut benefits out to all of these people. And it's just, it's horrific. So I just want to put that in context of the mental health strife that they're going to be under. It's going to be worse. It is just absolutely going to be worse. In addition to the fear of ICE, I think we're really fortunate that ICE has not geared up enough to make Champaign-Urbana a target, and they're really focusing on trying to embarrass Governor Pritzker and be in Chicago. But there is still a lot of fear, especially fear to go to Chicago for any kind of appointments. For those of you that don't know, immigration court is in Chicago. You either go to Chicago or some, I think for citizenship, you sometimes go to St. Louis. I think some of our clients have gone to St. Louis, but there's nothing here. And you don't have a choice. You either show up and risk getting detained by ICE, or if you don't show up for your appointment, you are on the expedited removal list, which means that ICE can come and just pick you up and take you away and deport you. So the risks are very real. We clearly need to provide as much support as we can for our immigrant neighbors. We are going to try, like Maria and ISCU, we've got a little bit of money that we're going to put aside for some food gift cards to try and get people through, and also for some emergency supplies. We generally don't distribute any kind of food at the refugee center, and please don't publicize this because we know we don't have enough for everybody. But we just don't want to be in a situation where somebody has come in and their kids haven't eaten in days and we have nothing to give them. And we will give them all of the food pantry resources we can. But for most of those, you have to go and you have to sign up. And it's not every day. It's what, maybe once a week or once a month with some. So we know there's going to be, you know, empty stomachs out there. We want to help as much as we can. Another factor is that the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service has raised its fees, including for asylum. Usually, before this, there was no fee to apply for asylum. The amount of the fees that they're raising is really egregious, and it's pretty clear that very few people are going to be able to afford to apply on their own. I mean, I can just summarize everything that's going on by saying this administration doesn't just want to prevent undocumented people from living in the U.S. They want to prevent almost all immigrants from coming to the U.S. They've cut the right now the refugee program is on pause. Last year, the presidential determination, the president gets to decide how many refugees come into the United States every year. Last year, the Biden administration, we were at 125,000, and we came really close to doing that across the country. Right now, the president was supposed to make a determination before October 1st, which is the start of the federal fiscal year. He did not. However, our sources are telling us that it could be as low as 7,500. And in our experience, we know that when a ceiling is set, you're going to get a little bit less than that ceiling just because of processing time and other complications that come into play. So they don't even let in any refugees. And these are people who have been vetted. They've been interviewed multiple times. They have passed a medical screening. The only refugees that they are interested in letting in are white Christian South Africans. So we're devastated at the Refugee Center about the refugee resettlement program. We worked really hard to build a robust team, giving wraparound services, including housing and employment counseling. It really is if you're coming as a refugee, it's such an advantage. I mean, they have so many more resources, or did before, as compared to somebody who's crossing the border without inspection. I mean, it's just a world of difference. And now that's been decimated. So I know this is, you know, hard conversations, but I just I say this just to make you all aware of that the change is coming from all directions, and it is very much on purpose. They've been planning this for the last 4 years with Project 2025, and it is a relentless attack on immigrants. And you know, we're here to do our part, whatever way we can. Like I said, I really appreciate your support and this opportunity to speak to you this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Doc. Sorry. Thank you, Executive Director Wilson. I think now is the time where we open up the floor for great dialogue, questions, comments, and thoughts.
Yeah. Get on it.
So you can go ahead.
Yeah. So I was, it's top of mind for me. I was speaking to a group of students last night, and this crisis was very much on their mind, and something that I'm hit again by my conversation with them and echoed here is that these are man-made crises, right? These aren't natural disasters. These are things that we have created. Right, we make people undocumented because of our processes. Somebody crossing the border does not make them undocumented. It's because we refuse to update our system to document them. It's our failure. And that goes on Democrats and Republicans. I think, so to me, the reaction of sympathy doesn't make much sense, because it's people who are elected in our name who have created this crisis. I also think it's interesting. I mean, one other thing before I move on. These immigration laws that we now have that have created this crisis were modeled after the Jim Crow era. Jim Crow. It's not just that they are immigrants and we don't like brown people. It's that we see brown people as an economic unit, just in the same way that black people were the foundation of the economy. They relied on black people for free labor, even to some points refusing to plow their fields with the latest technology because they wanted to rely on slave labor. So too in our food system today. So again, we maintain this system through our consent, through who we have elected. So I really would like to make that clear, and also to highlight we need to move from sympathy in the way that we discuss this. So in that line, my question to the panelists today is, what asks do you have from state and local government? Being the local side myself, I know it's it can feel ambiguous to say local government. So when I say local government, I'm thinking not just county board, which is I'm vice chair of, but also your sheriff's department, your court system, your treasurer, anything that falls under those umbrellas. I'm interested to hear any and see any gaps that you might see.
Well, I think we're going to see a huge gap in the need for housing, money to pay for housing, and money to pay for food. It's possible that there's been some rumblings. You know, we are partners with the state as an Illinois Welcoming Center, and there are some rumblings of them getting some emergency direct assistance, but I don't know that that's definite right now, and I certainly don't know how much that would be. But yeah, the need is going to be so great. I mean, I would think you mentioned sheriff's office, adherence to the Illinois Trust Act. And I really appreciate that. I think it was months ago, there was a meeting when all of the leaders of the various departments in our area committed to the Illinois Trust Act. And I don't know how much that will affect one of our undocumented clients as feeling better, but it definitely makes me feel better. And if we can say to our clients, look, our local departments are not going to cooperate with ICE, I mean, hopefully that is some solace. I mean, we're just going to need people to understand how what a target is on the back of immigrants right now, and to try and be as generous and give them as much space as possible, because they really literally are under attack.
Yeah, I mean, I think if it hasn't become clear already, and I know this is something that Lisa and I have discussed in private as well, is that we were already in crisis before the second election, and it's hard to even imagine where we're going to go from here. We were already really having a hard time putting people in homes. We were already really having a hard time feeding people. We were already feeling the weight of trying to connect people to legal services. The organizations here locally and everywhere else were already feeling completely saturated, and now that has just picked up, and we don't even know how much that's going to be multiplied by. So I think just kind of reiterating that. I'm obviously navigating a lot of these things for the first time, but something that keeps me up at night is, like, where is the measure of accountability locally? So we've seen what Chicago has accomplished, and I say accomplished because I'm genuinely proud to be in that close of a proximity to a city that has handled the immigration crisis the way that it has. If it isn't something that's known already, ICE is in our communities at least once a week, if not twice a week, and it is picking up. And it's not, I think that there's an understanding out there, maybe a misconception, that it's like, well, they're only coming after criminals and they're only coming with warrants. That's not the case. You know, just last week, there was two spotted vehicles driving around with ICE written right on them. We were only able to confirm that they took one person, but they spent quite a long time riding around locally. So when I look at that, I see they're testing the waters. They're trying to see how much pushback they're going to get doing what they're doing. And so when I reference the measure of accountability, I don't think it is fair for local service immigrations, nonprofits, to have to be coming up with the solutions. And it's not a matter to me in this, I mean, I'm not trying to elicit fear, but it's not a matter of if, it is a matter of when. Things will get more chaotic here. Does that mean it's going to get as chaotic as Chicago? I don't know. But if they're coming every week and it's picking up, it's just a matter of time before it starts to really create disruption. And so we have to prepare for that. So, you know, I think you guys probably saw the Illinois Secretary of State talking about how ICE is not allowed to switch its license plates. So where's the measure of accountability for that? If someone in the community sees an ICE member changing their license plate after a deportation or before or whenever, where do we go with that information? If our neighbors are on the streets protesting, and I'm not talking about a No Kings rally where the government is aware of what we're doing, but I'm talking about local manifestations, then where's the measure of accountability when our community members start getting hurt? Where's the measure of accountability when non-immigrants who are trying to put themselves between what's going on start getting taken away? So I'm in a position now where we're having a lot of conversations with a lot of different people, a lot of people running for, you know, things like Congress and local government. And I'm really learning the vastness and the amount of resource that this community has, the amount of potential, the amount of intelligence, the amount of awareness. So I do think we're in the position to ask, like, what can you guys, and when I say you guys, I don't just mean this board, but I mean the city of Champaign, the city of Urbana, like, what can you guys do for us? Because for us, it's like we're just waiting for the crash. That's a lot to carry. It's also a lot for entry-level case managers to be wondering themselves. So I think inevitably we have to start planning. We can't wait to respond until it gets too bad that we don't know what to do next.
All right.
Can I finish that up just real quick?
Oh, yes,
yep.
Please.
Okay. I guess I want to follow up and challenge people who are watching this feed. I know I encourage the young people who I spoke to last night to tune in. I think these are interesting responses and sharp responses. Something I encourage, I know that every member of the county board and every government official is in the county level is doing it, are looking to other counties and localities to see how they are, within the state of Illinois, because our laws are unique to us, how they are responding to this man-made crisis. And so if you are in communities, this is how we passed 12 weeks paid parental leave for all Champaign County employees. We saw that DuPage County was doing it. If you come across an example, and we'll be doing this as well, send it to us. Send it to your representative on the county board, and we will do everything we can to mirror that policy.
So just a couple of things, and I guess I'll preface this by saying, please believe my heart and my intentions. I don't want to misspeak. Something that spoke to me when you spoke about man-made tragedies. Wow, that really is true. You know, so many times I think we have the right intentions, but we're causing all this havoc. everyone who's on these boards, who've watched these meetings, whatever, know that I sometimes have a differing political party and things like that. And, you know, someone made a comment and I was like, you know, we need to not stay in our boxes anymore. Just because I typically identify as Republican or conservative doesn't mean that I don't want to join you hand in hand, because there's things going on out there that are inhumane. You know, and so it makes me cringe when I hear things that, you know, our president is saying. I'm like, what? Can someone shut his mic off? I mean, do I think that's his heart? I want to hope it's not, but I don't know. I'm not him. But that goes both ways. I had seen the quote about, you know, the Democrats for 12 times have voted down this SNAP thing. True. But then I also realize 12 times maybe the Republicans didn't say, okay, maybe we can compromise on this. So I'm so sick of the news media, the social media, all that. It's just we have to kind of join hands, say you're a little different than me, but let's talk this out. So that was kind of trajectory I just took. I do have a couple questions, and if this is something that would be better for you to cover, like, after the meeting or something. I just have some general, like, questions just because I don't know. So I've seen the post before where, you know, hey, ICE is in town, beware, da-da-da-da. So typically, are they coming in and just kind of profiling, or do they have a list of individuals they're looking for? Because some media is trying to say, oh, we're trying to get out. And I think you'd even spoke on it, Maria, but we're trying to get rid of the illegal, you know, convicts, the bad people. Or are they just coming in and saying, by the color of your skin or the way you talk, I want to talk to you. I mean, so I guess just kind of how are we seeing ICE maybe in our community? And then another thing was just, I think you'd also talked about, we need to have hope. And right now there's not a lot of hope in many avenues right now. You know, I was talking to Elaine, you know, I work for General Mills, and so obviously there's a lot of concern in the stores I'm going into in regards to all this change with SNAP. General Mills partnered with Walmart. We've got some special lower priced cereals coming in the back door in hopes that maybe you can afford $2.97 if you can't afford the $4.44 size. I mean, we're sending an extra soup because that's a lower, you know, cash ring. And so it affects me, even though, like, I don't get SNAP. It doesn't day-to-day affect, but it's affecting my job. It's affecting the managers I deal with. It's the people I see on the streets. I'm thinking, you know, I just need to make a donation of cash to Illinois Food Bank rather than, oh, here's some things out of my pantry, you know. So I keep telling people, a dollar equals $10. Give cash to your food banks. And I thought I had one more idea, but just I think in so many ways we just need to lock arms and try to help each other. And one of the reasons why I continue to be on this board is I'm trying to make myself a better, more educated person. And again, you know, I hear things on ICE and I'm like, well, yeah, they're just trying to get the bad guys out. But I'm starting to not believe that either. So I would love if you can kind of either now or later someone can inform me of what is the reality that we're seeing maybe in our communities.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously want to show up with integrity and tell you that, like, the answers that I give you are from my personal experience and from the circles that I'm able to receive information from and the experiences that I have. But I think this is a question that you should ask to anybody who works directly with immigrants because it's a very complex system. Like Lisa, for example, is able to break down the actual law in a way, whereas like I tend to lean more maybe into like the emotional experience that immigrants are having, right? We all kind of have different places where we feel stronger. And so I'll just answer my part. But I think that, like, I'm happy to hear that you're like, just tell me, you know, like, to your first point, I can tell you, like, as an immigrant myself, like, it's funny how much the United States gets caught up in seeing immigration as like a bipartisan issue, like where it's like, oh, it's like Republicans hate immigrants and Democrats love them, when that's not our truth necessarily. So like we don't necessarily benefit greatly from having Democrats in office, in the sense that there's still mass deportations, for example, that occurred under Obama. And so when you're talking about locking arms, it's like, if we're seeing due process be violated anywhere, that's something all of us should be scared about. That's not an opinion-based thing. That's like our constitutional rights are all of a sudden up for debate, and that should be a problem that we all look towards. To your second point that I think was about like how ICE is showing up locally, I think it was definitely a narrative that got into a lot of people's heads of, well, they're only taking the criminals. The criminalization of black and brown people in this country is one of the biggest issues. Like, we could probably sit and have a whole discussion just about that in and of itself. This, in my opinion, is another attempt to do that. It's to kind of label these are criminals, and so, like, we need to get them out of here. So even you guys were hearing me earlier talk about clients that are fleeing government persecution, that are fleeing conditions that almost anyone would want to run from. Sorry, this is heavy and emotional, and my brain gets kind of overwhelmed. But if we in the United States, let's say there of course are criminals who are immigrants, right? So if the idea is let's just deport them back to where they come from, and I'm talking about hard crimes, human trafficking, murder, things that we can all kind of agree on, this is dangerous, this is a big problem, right? If they just get deported back to their country, how is that solving the problem? You get what I'm saying? So, like, they're just getting sent right back into the same tunnel to create more harm from where they came and to maybe even come back in. Who knows? I don't think that's a good solution. Second, I don't know if you know this, but if you immigrate into the United States and you get deported and you come back in, then you're a felon. It's called felon reentry. So something as simple as being deported and then having to find your way back into the country makes you a felon in this country. I wish, honestly, that I could, like, say to you, yes, here are all the deportations that happened. They've only happened to people that are really committing serious crimes. There was a Monday morning once where they just pulled over a truck of workers that were going to work at, like, 4 in the morning, and they took 10 of them. None of them had warrants. None of them were, like, there are people in the community who rigorously do this work, who look these names up, who trace where they are, who do, like, something that, for example, I don't have time to do, right? There was not a single one that they could find anything on. And when each member that was taken is the main breadwinner in their family. So now you've got a family, children, that, you know, a lot of them become our clients, that are completely destabilized because one morning, you know, the main breadwinner went to work and then didn't come back. Most of the times when we find out about ICE, we're finding out about it through kids in middle school and in high school who see it in their neighborhoods. The reason that most people don't know that ICE is in town is because they're going into areas where only black and brown people live, where only immigrants live. So it's not really affecting you if you live in an area. I mean, even myself, I'm privileged. I live near Harvest Market, right? I don't see ICE driving by where I'm at. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that, like, one, even the theory of we're only taking criminals is problematic and flawed and is not being handled in a way that is actually about justice. It's not actually about protecting anybody. And two, what, based on what I'm seeing, and if you look at it at, like, a national level, what's going on, for what possible reason would children be zip-tied to each other and then pulled up into a helicopter in Chicago? What possible thing could those children have done to deserve that? So when you break down the deportations, I don't think there's any way you could leave with a conclusion that they're just trying to get rid of the bad guys. They're bad guys because they're immigrants, whether they're doing the bad stuff or not. So I'm not going to take up too much time, but, yeah, I think it's a narrative that really does need to be challenged because it's dehumanizing. Parents are in line waiting to pick up their kids from preschool, and their kids are stuck at school wondering when their dad is going to come pick them up. Yeah. And if they really cared about the criminal aspect of it, then they would follow due process, and they're not. So, yeah.
Well, and I kind of have encouraged, you know, even maybe even during the election time, you know, sometimes we just need to sit down with two people. And actually, Lynn actually spoke on this the other day because I said, oh, you know, so-and-so, we're so far apart. And she's like, no, you're not. If you really sat down, you two are very close together. Just you still have that R&D, you know. And so I'm learning now sometimes I will be vulnerable and ask the questions and say, hey, I don't know, so can you tell me from your experiences? And recently I spoke to a gentleman, and I asked him, I said, you know, I don't feel comfortable just asking anyone this question, but I was like, do you know any people who are here that are not legal? And he's like, his own wife. Mm-hmm. And it about breaks my heart because they're the mom. She's a mom of three beautiful children. But because she came in here, I think, as a child, but she has a work permit. But he said, at any time, they might be like, get out. And I'm like, that's your wife. And so I think that's where maybe because I asked the question, I realized I'm a lot more directly affected by this than I thought. And again, I don't believe the narrative that we're only getting the criminals out. I don't think that's accurate either. But that's what's being spun by some people, oh, we're only getting the bad ones out. No, you're not. And with my, you know, past, you know, volunteerism with, you know, public education, stuff like that as a school board president, you know, I hear so many people are like, well, ICE in the schools. Well, first of all, I know they can't do that. but it doesn't eliminate the fear and the constant worry of, are they going to show up here? Is dad going to pick me up, or are they going to pick up dad on, you know? So I get it and stuff. So I'm so thankful for the agencies that are doing the things they can. I'm very much like Emily, you know, what else can we do to help? What can, you know, the county board, what can, you know, and I've said, what can I personally do?
Just want to chime in, this body here.
Yes. You know, so I just really think that, having these difficult conversations is so important. And so I really appreciate, you know, our presenters tonight. I really appreciate your clients and stuff who've obviously in confidence shared stuff with you, experiences with you, so that you can come on their behalf and say, hey, here's the reality. Here's what's going on. Well, here's what we need help with. So thank you. Huge kudos to all of you for what you do, because it's not a job that when you leave your office at 5 o'clock, your day's over. Probably at 2 a.m., you're thinking of someone that you spoke to at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate it. Yeah.
So, you know, after hearing everybody's you know, comments and just hitting all the information about what's going on in the community and thinking about what we as a mental health board can do, you know, some of the things I think about is, you know, obviously what Mrs. Jimenez said about, you know, having a Spanish A meeting in town, having a domestic violence support group in town. You know, from a pediatric perspective, I think about a few things. You know, how do we improve the feeling of safety for community members, especially children? How do we help them with parental loss if a parent gets deported? How do we, you know, have support groups in schools for children to help with this? Because something in pediatrics is adverse childhood experiences, and this is one of them, multiple of them. And that's going to increase the risk of the long-term health of those children and how their brain develops in many different ways in terms of, you know, cardiovascular risk, heart attacks and stroke, increased aggression, increased violence, increased anxiety, depression, increased risk of cancer. And if you have six or more of adverse childhood experiences, it decreases your life expectancy by 20 years. So I guess for me, I think about what we can do maybe in the future is, you know, looking at how we can support agencies to develop some of these programs so that maybe we can try to blunt some of the long-term effect. And then if there's any other low-hanging fruit that we can address, definitely I want agencies to definitely communicate that to us and to staff. And if there's any blind spots that we're not hitting, definitely I want to make sure that we're addressing those. It's not anything that's going to be fixed overnight. You know, learning about the issue is one part of it. Finding solutions is another part, and implementing them and the long-term plans of these is going to take many years. So just having that thought process in mind of that this is a marathon, not a sprint. Do we know agencies, if there is money available, do you feel that there is community members that would be able to create some of these support groups for these families and community members?
Yeah, I mean, I plan on using a lot of the money that we receive to make that possible. But obviously these things are being built for the first time from the ground up. So like they will take time. It'll take trial and error. I mean, just for example, getting 10 immigrants the other day to sit down for an immigrant advisory committee meant finding a location that had a play area for kids, getting volunteers to set up those activities so the kids could be entertained and the moms could be far away from the kids. It meant getting food together, securing transportation for every single family member. These are just barriers that our immigrants' families like have to jump through. So it's not just as simple as like, yep, we're going to have a support group on November 10th. And it means we have to do a lot of the legwork, and that's okay. But that is going to take time, and it's going to take a lot of effort, which is okay. But yeah.
Well, one of the problems that we have as a group is we're by definition a reactive group. You know, people come to us and then we can give them money. And I think, but we don't found the groups. But so I've been sitting here thinking of how we can support conversations that will lead to those gaps being filled by the agencies that we help, you know, and some of that is probably in committee meetings that our staff go to with other agencies. But I don't know the answer right now, but it's something I want to think about I think we've done a good job of funding things that in another community might not be funded. But how do we plant the seeds to say, this is something your agency needs to do, or if it were, and we can't promise either. We can't say, well, if somebody would do that, we'll fund it, because, you know, the process is too specific for that. So I think that's something for us to think about, how we can help generate programs that need to be generated.
I think Awad has a comment to make. We have some robust conversation going on in a chat. So Awad, jump in there.
Thank you so much. I think one way that we can help from now is, again, planting the seed. If the Middle East and North Africa is a category on the census for 2030, we can start pondering now on ways in which we can help to be ahead of the game at getting federal grants to help these communities before they become public. And this is something that we can completely help with.
Are there any other comments in the chat or anything like that?
I think Dr. Fisher and Ms. Wilson was exchanging some conversation. I don't know if Dr. Fisher, you want to speak on it, or you're okay with everything.
Thanks, Leanne. I just was asking about, you know, I have a lot of family in the Chicagoland area and friends, many friends who are in schools, and it's just been really hard. But anyway, and I've been in trainings about different levels of training that happen. And from my understanding, this network of support and action and collective action has been started I think they said like 2011 or 2012, and then just really got activated in 2018, 2019. So they have many years, I guess. They've been doing a lot of work to prepare for this moment. So they have, you know, kind of this initial level of actions. People see things in the community. They're out. They've got whistles, and they're actively, you know, trying to scare off ICE. And then when they witness something, they send it to this rapid response team, which my understanding, which then is the folks that can, you know, are trained a little bit more, that can kind of come and be a witness and get information from people who are being actively detained and or family members that are there, left there. And then there's this whole family support network of like resources around the Chicagoland area that can try to help kids and families address and, you know, neighbors get the support that they need. And I was just asking, I haven't heard anything about that here. I just was asking, do we have like something replicable here? And I think Ms. Wilson, you said, yeah, that there is.
So the family support network that you're talking about and the rapid response, that is mostly coordinated by the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and they are in the Chicago area. but they have, you know, grantees and partners throughout the state, including us, and also the Immigration Project. I know there is a rapid response team of sorts locally. I will have to see if they want to be contacted directly, or if it's a case where you call the number for the Illinois Coalition, and then they say, okay, they're in Champaign, we're calling over to Immigration Project, and they're getting their rapid response team ready. And just so you know, too, I mean, within our own offices, I know that we've taught a lot of Know Your Rights seminars. We've distributed a lot of Know Your Rights information. We've also trained our staff on drills in the event that ICE were to come into our office space. Who would do what? Who would start filming? Who would get on the phone and if needed to call, you know, Champaign Police, where we're located in Champaign. We've gone very detailed into what our emergency response would be, and a big part of that is, of course, trying to keep our clients safe. We also have, if anybody reports to us that ICE is within a mile of our office, somebody from our office is physically going to go out and check that out. Because then if they are in the area, we want to be able to call clients, contact clients and say, don't come here today. Come another time. ICE is in the area. Don't come here today. So I think there are a lot of people who are trying to, you know, act as a rapid response team. I'll have to check in with them and see what they would prefer the public to do. So, thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think that would be great because one thing that like the boards could do and the, certainly the city and the county, or, you know, but, you know, is inform kind of what the plan is. If you are just a community member out and about, what you can do, because I think like so many people are not in tuned on, you know, all the things that are happening so intensely in the Chicagoland area.
Yeah. I would say something, you know, that you can always do because it's legal to do it in Illinois in a public space is record.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things I had a question about is, do we know, I know that they've committed to the Sheriff's Office have committed to the Trust Act. Has there been any statement from the county board or the executive or, you know, the mayors about, ICE not being able to use any public facilities? And would that be helpful? Just thinking about, you know, when someone asks, like, what's your ask for us? And then someone said, like, well, we need government to do more. So that was one thing is, like, you know, can we make a statement or have we made a statement that they can't use any public buildings? And then law enforcement, have they committed to if they witness immigration officers, you know, switching plates and doing all kinds of aggressive things that are illegal, are they, you know, where's the line for law enforcement, local law enforcement?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do know that local law enforcement, while they expressed their support for the Trust Act, they also said that they cannot alert us if they know ICE is in town. So it kind of goes both ways. As far as using government buildings, yeah, that would be a great thing if they could make that statement saying that ICE is not welcome to use any government facilities in Champaign or Urbana or the county.
Thank you for letting me chime in, Mr. Bryson, because I was probably not going to unmute, so I appreciate the invitation.
So I wanted to speak. So again, I'm vice chair of the Champaign County Board. I want to address a few things that have been said here, right? The Trust Act is state law. There have been statements, there have been conferences in which local police departments and the sheriff's departments have talked about the implications and educated the community on that, but it's not an option for them. Like even a public statement is a public statement, but they're held, they can't, the federal government cannot hijack local resources to enforce their laws that they made, right? That's on their dime, not ours. We're not donating money to the federal government. So there is that. I can say that has not been, police officers not communicating to me about ICE activity has not been my experience. I can tell you we have a sheriff who is dedicated to working with our community and is serious about getting accurate information to our migrant communities so they can have a sense, they know when to panic, right? I think that's key. It is important to note that ICE is not obligated to report to local law enforcement, but that does not mean that local law enforcement cannot communicate to local groups, right? So I wanted to highlight that. I also wanted to mention, I think use of county buildings is important and something that the county executive's office is currently working on. We will pass a resolution that would make plain you cannot use county buildings to enforce ICE activity. I think the next step is going to need to be from the cities. You cannot use police department parking lots to launch your ICE activities. So it's got to be multi-level. And so the follow-up suggestion that I would make, and I know I think these kind of study sessions are really helpful and generative for this reason, I think we don't have a working group amongst elected officials and local groups yet on how to respond to this. I've mentioned a few times researching, looking at other local solutions. That's work that other local officials could do in the same room. I think with that ask, if we're really serious about it, a working group that's truly going to do something would require staff support. So if that's something that we are interested in, I know who I would ask. It's in the county executive's office and our grant coordinator, right, ways to fund things. I would encourage members of the Urbana City Council and the Champaign City Council to think in the same lines. Who would you send? What kind of staff resources can you commit? And then working forward from that. I know who I'll be following up with.
This question goes out to anyone. So if someone is going to say the county courthouse, because they have a speeding ticket, technically can ICE apprehend them there? What about like at the federal courthouse? I mean, I guess that's kind of one of my questions. At this point, it seems ICE feels like they have no boundaries.
Yeah.
And is that technically how it legally is, or can they not be like at the county courthouse, but they could be at the federal courthouse? I guess that's kind of my question.
So under previous administrations, there was something called, you know, safe spaces, and that included the courts, schools, and any kind of medical facility. The Trump administration has pushed back against all of that. So that's why ICE has been showing up at the courthouse. Or outside. They can't go in. They show up outside. And so we've been advising people, if you have to go to court, take somebody you trust with you and hopefully an advocate that, you know, knows what they're doing so that you can be protected. But they haven't been going into the facilities, but they've certainly been hanging out around the facilities, including schools up in the Chicago area. Churches, those were also formerly safe spaces. They're hanging out outside of churches. So yeah, unfortunately those used to be safe spaces. They are no longer.
I also know that there has been apprehensions from ICE at our local courthouse right across the street for both criminal and civil matters. As far as I know, that has not continued. I think it was very captured and it went viral. And so but that definitely took place in our local community. Everyone looks really tired and sad. I always feel a little like, I'm like, no, but I mean, you did speak about hope earlier, and you know, just kind of like looping around to what I talked about earlier with like co-regulation, like this is a co-regulated space, even if we're all tense and this is hard to talk about and probably hungry and winding down. Like when I walk into these spaces, like part of me leaves feeling heavier, but part of me does leave feeling lighter. sharing the load is like super, super, super important. And I think for so long, immigration has been something that has been like left to the revolutionaries. And I think we're in a time right now where we're all starting to actually take more responsibility for it. So I'm just really grateful that we're able to have this conversation. I hope it's not the last one that we have, because things will change, things will alter, they'll get more intense, or, you know, we'll make progress one way or another. And so continuing to have the conversation is really important to me specifically. And I think I probably speak to the other panelists when I say that as well.
Thank you for those encouraging comments. This is Ann Robin. I'm a local physician, and I'm the medical director of Champaign-Urbana Public Health, which has been working intensively with our refugee and immigrant populations. I just want to remind everybody here, is anybody here a full-blooded Native American or descendant of Native Americans? Anybody in this room on Zoom? We're all descendants of immigrants, every single one of us. And the people that came recently are no different than the people that came previously. We're all a mixed lot. Some of us are wonderful people. Some of us are less wonderful people. We're all people with needs. We're all people with talents and abilities. And we're all community members. So I could go on and on, but I think that if we remember that we are all descendants of immigrants, except for those very few who are descendants of the original Native population, and we need to be working together as a community. I really like your idea of having a working group, and I think that as little as this seems, to get together and spend 2 hours talking about these things and we go away and there's still, the problems are huge. The fact that we're talking about them is good, and we need to continue talking about them and figuring out how to do things about them. Thank you.
I also wanted to chime in. I don't even know totally what's going to come out of my mouth, but I appreciated, Emily, when you talked about, like, this is a problem we created through our systems, and it requires a systems response. And as our boards, we are part of the system. And I have been thinking about, like, ways that we can think about our priorities more broadly, like when we think about strengthening the behavioral health workforce, that also includes making sure that our behavioral health workforce understands these issues, or recruiting people who do understand these issues, recruiting bilingual therapists, and incentivizing agencies who do that, you know, with our resources. It means thinking about, like, the hotlines that we fund, whether through an agency or more broadly, are they equipped to respond to individuals from the various communities that are being targeted right now? Are they equipped to respond to individuals in crisis, including suicidal crisis? Because in my therapy job, I mean, and all the therapists I know, there's a lot of people who are at the edge right now. And I think, you know, that's really important too. But I also think it is an individual problem, because it involves individual human beings dehumanizing other human beings. And I don't understand how somebody can look at another human being and not see them as a person. And to keep hearing this word illegal, like as though the person in front of you is not a person, is wrong. And so I implore everyone, especially white people, please talk to the other people in your lives and challenge them on this. It can be done very gently, but like that is conditioned and it can be unlearned. So I just also wanted to say that, and just as I, you know, have said in other meetings, like I want this to be a community where everybody belongs. And that is something that we don't get to earn the designation of a safe. We have to earn the designation of a safe community, of safe spaces. But I know sitting here on this board, that's the position I take. And I just thinking about what can we do as a system and what can we do as individual people is important.
Well, is there any other comments or questions online or any? Leon, is there anyone else online? No. All right, well, with that, I would like to thank everybody for being here. You know, everybody's insight is very valuable, and, you know, I hope everyone came away learning something and, you know, with more questions for the future. Obviously, I agree. I think we should have, you know, future sessions on this so we can, you know, think more about possible solutions and answers for the long term. So with that, I'll move to the public participation and agency input. We'll leave it to 5 minutes if there's any further agencies that want to make a comment. We'll limit to 5 minutes. Seeing none, we'll move to board announcements and input. Is there any board announcements?
Oh, I wanted to note the. Do we want to talk about the survey?
Oh. Yes. So I guess Leon or Lynn.
Well, there are other materials in the packet that I hope are helpful. That each of the presenters gave us a little bit of information about their organizations and links to other information. So if that's interesting to you all, it's in there. And then we did develop a survey. This was, I'm trying to get to it. Oh my gosh. Okay. This was a lot, Leon, Bryson, and Maria put this together. And then we managed it in the same way that we did the survey of LGBTQIA plus individuals, which had over 100 responses. I was not at all surprised that we didn't have very many responses to this. I did think it was interesting, and it confirmed something that I think some of you have told us before, that people maybe don't read and write in Conjobal. They speak it, but they read and write in Spanish. So we had a lot of Spanish responses, and about half of them mentioned that they speak Conjobal. So I thought, okay, well, it's only 9 people, but they proved the point. So anyway, it's a very small sample, and therefore I didn't include charts, but I did include all of the comments, because that is really where we get, where we learn so much. So this is like Google translations with like our very minimal knowledge of Spanish and French to support, you know, little adjustments to what Google came up with. But I think you can get the gist, and you shared already some of that you had in your group meeting, some similar, like, not surprising responses about what people thought was going to happen. And then what happened? Some of these people have been here over 10 years. And so anyway.
I was just going to say, you know, it's like the way we went about it was pulling the questions that we thought would be most effective. So I guess in order to answer survey questions like this, I think you have to be able to zoom out of your own experience and almost be able to take like an eagle-eye view of your life. And for various factors, that's not something that I think a lot of immigrants, specifically with like a lower level of education, are able to do easily, or they've never been asked to reflect ever once on some of these questions. So I know Lisa and I talked a little bit about it, and I'll let her speak about her specific experience and take on it. But I do think it's something that would be worth sitting down specifically to try to create in a new way that might be more receptive, like just all across the board, all across the immigration spectrum, because it wasn't. The feedback from staff was that it was not particularly easy to do and to distribute.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, I mean, ever since I started working in the immigrant space, you know, obviously you get funding from grantors and grantors want to see, you know, data and surveys of well-being is often a way of getting that data. It's so difficult and it is so it's so time consuming for our staff. It's incredibly time consuming. I mean, when you think about when you go to a social service agency and you're dealing, you know, you're at the DMV and you're dealing with something, if you're, you know, changing the title or something that involves a little bit more, or you're going to, you know, you've taken your mom to a doctor's appointment and now the social worker is coming to talk to you about, you know, what the options are after she fell. And when you're translating all of that, I mean, add times three to that appointment. Because by the time you have the back and forth and then somebody has to speak in chunks so that the interpreter can interpret, and same thing with the survey. I mean, when people are coming in our door, they usually have something specific in mind that they need. We then ask them additional questions and make an assessment and do an intake. But they're usually in our office for quite a while, and sometimes with young children who are running all over the place, it is not easy at all to then take that additional time to really translate a survey and get their answers, especially if they're long form answers like that.
So was it helpful to use the Spanish language and French language versions of the survey?
I thought it, but we really didn't get much of a response.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's less about the translation of language and more so the translation of concepts that are potentially reactivating to people's nervous systems that require a lot of explanation. I mean, like, for example, like, I come from a country that gets made fun of for speaking more formally, right? And so constantly at work, I find myself in situations where I'm like, I need to find a more simple way to say this, because if I say it the way it might just come across, they're not going to be able to necessarily know what I'm trying to say. So with every client, it's different. With every background, with every educational background, with every culture, I think that it's different. I guess that's why I kind of said, like, sitting down and trying to create these in a more intentional, not that you guys weren't intentional, but in a more intentional way with maybe feedback from what we think could be, you know, maybe it is maybe just 2, 3, 4 questions, or maybe it's just one question that's open-ended or whatever it might be. I don't have the answers necessarily, but I think it's just, these are questions that are more than likely they've never considered before.
So I really didn't even want to do a survey. I was hoping for individual impact statements. And I think that's something we could receive and share at any time, not just because we're in a hurry to put a board packet together. I think if people choose to share information with you and say it's okay to share it with us and publicly, that I think we would just make space in a board packet for it.
I think if we opened it up to where we didn't have to use names, or even if we could use a made up name, I mean, I could probably sit here right now and just a lot of different like stories that I know would be really impactful for people to hear and learn. Then it takes a little bit of pressure off of the client. And so, yeah, that's something I can think about and work on.
Well, but still, like, given all the things that we've talked about and heard about tonight, like, I could, like, time matters, and maybe this is not a huge priority, but if there is an opportunity, I want to say we're not going to put a barrier on this end as far as sharing. So
I think there's a comment, and it says we may want to consider short videos as well in various languages and dialects as well.
Yeah, that's a great idea. We have some WhatsApp groups with our clients based on, you know, different language, and for those that don't read, and we just send an audio message.
I mean, I think it is worth, obviously, like, this would be probably one of the most intimidating spaces that some of my clients have ever. I was honestly intimidated when I walked in. But our local immigrant community needs to know, even if they don't understand how systems work. Like, I mean, like, their positions and a board and all of these things make no sense to the average immigrant. But to know that the local community that does have power, does have authority, does have resources, cares to hear about their experience. And that's what I think is the most important thing about all of it.
And I was going to even say, you know, we... you know, as a board member, you know, I love quarterly reports, especially when they kind of, you know, share a few details. This would be a perfect opportunity, even if it was, you know, hey, one of my clients brought up this quarter, and because that would maybe say, hey, is that something we need to dive deep? Very informal would just be, I would love that, you know.
All right. I guess with that, the last thing is, I guess, do we have any board announcements or input from the board? I guess, Emily, if there's any board.
Not at all.
Yeah. Excellent. All right.
Well, wait a minute. Okay. I just want to, because I always go to the Community Coalition.
Go ahead.
I'm just thinking the Community Coalition needs to hear about all of this. And so I hope maybe to get in touch with Tracy Parsons, if you could do that, and have him put you guys on the program, because that is such a huge cross-section of the helping community every month. I think it really needs to be the business of the coalition to listen to this.
We can do that right now.
I'd also just like members of this body to repost the video from tonight. It seems like expanding the reach of what was discussed would be helpful to our entire community.
All right. I know people are
feeling antsy,
feeling ready to, you know, take this discussion to, you know, the next meeting when we, you know, think about all the information we've processed tonight and think about other questions and possible answers for the future. So with that, I will move to adjourn. Thank you, everybody.
Record.